I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
You don't put those inside of you, do you?
This is a show about women.
I mean, you do?
Yes.
Finally, a show about women that isn't just a thinly veiled aspirational nightmare. It's not hosted, not narrated. We're just dropping into a woman's world.
I found out when my dad was gay when I was 10. We were in a convertible on the 405 freeway, listening to the B-52s. And looking back, I should have said, this is gay. This is already all gay.
Listen to Finally a Show on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances. Whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death, we all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter offer code HISTORY at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
I'm Kristen Conger.
And I'm Caroline Irvin.
And together we host the podcast Stuff Mom Never Told You that gets down to the business of being women from every imaginable angle.
New episodes come out Mondays and Wednesdays on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy B. Wilson.
Tracy, it's time for more October horror.
Yay!
Yay! This time we're going to delve into not just an October spooky story, but a story of spooky storytellers. We're going to talk about a famous theater of Paris, and its name translates to Big Puppet or Big Puppet Show, which could perhaps to some ears suggest light, silly fare. But the works performed at the Théâtre du Grand Guignol were aimed at adult audiences, and they were not for the faint of heart. The roots of the film horror genre are in the plays of the Grand Guignol, and the plays that were staged there really became known for telling the darker side of, or for exploring the darker side of storytelling, often in really visceral and very gruesome and explicit and graphic ways. It was outrageous and terrifying and sometimes scandalous, and it became a beloved fixture of the Parisian theatrical scene in the early 1900s. And throughout the 19th century, faits divers were incredibly popular, and these were short, sensational stories that were printed in French papers, and they were frequently illustrated, and they reported true-life sort of crime stories rife with gory details. And unlike fairy tales or morality stories, these usually did not end happily. And in some ways, the taste for stories of this nature, which developed in the consciousness of France throughout the 1800s, really set the perfect scene for the Théâtre du Grand Guignol.
The story of the Grand Guignol starts in 1897 with Oscar Metenier when he purchased a theater in the Quartier Pigalle area of Paris. He had worked on the police force, and one of his duties was watching over death row prisoners at the time.
basically in the time that was leading up to their executions. He also worked as a tabloid journalist before he became a playwright.
Metenier had been working with André Antoine at the Théâtre Libre, which staged stories of the lower classes of Paris. They really were kind of doing this whole naturalist thing that was growing in popularity. But that theater had really struggled, and it shut its doors for good in the mid-1890s. During the run of Théâtre Libre, Metenier had written some of the most provocative short plays that were staged there.
The Théâtre du Grand Guignol sat at the end of a small cul-de-sac called the Impasse Chaptal. It had originally been built as a chapel, and some of the original chapel decor remained, including angel sculptures hanging over the orchestra pit and seating boxes, which, due to their carved wood paneling, looked like confessionals.
And the stage there was a tiny square, 20 feet by 20 feet. That's about 6 by 6 meters. And there were somewhere between 230 and 285 seats, depending on what source you're reading.
One of the reasons Metenier started this venue in the smallest theater in Paris was to mount his own productions. His naturalist plays were just not the kind of thing that other playhouses were willing to produce. He had done some work writing farces and prose, but Metenier eventually went back to short plays.
Like those that he had worked on at the Théâtre Libre, Oscar's plays written for the Grand Guignol featured characters of the street, such as hustlers, sex workers, and homeless people. And he launched his theater on April 13th of 1897 with a slate of 7 shorts. 2 dark tales performed that evening were written by Metenier, while the other 5 were a mix of comedy and drama that had been written by other writers.
This mix of styles was part of an approach that Metenier started that he called hot and cold theater. Dark or gruesome fare was alternated with often bawdy comedic pieces. Because the theater would run anywhere from 4 to 7 different plays every night, they could take the audience through a series of emotional highs and lows over the course of one evening. As a result of this style switching, the horror seemed more frightening and the comedy seemed funnier.
Yeah, it's often explained as if you run hot water on your hands and then switch to cold, the cold seems icier than it is and vice versa. So that same sort of thing was being applied to staging their productions for the evening. And while Metenier had thought that in running his own theater house, he'd have the freedom to stage the shows he wanted, it turned out that the Paris police actually felt a little bit differently about the situation. One of his first shows, Mademoiselle Fifi, which was an adaptation of a novel, was shut down temporarily by police censors because the main character was a sex worker.
Although the police didn't appreciate the gritty realism of Metenier's plays, audiences really did. The Grand Guignol was successful, basically immediately.
Yeah, people really loved it. But even though it was doing quite well, Oscar Metenier did not head up the theater for long. In 1898, just the following year, Max Maury took over as director. And Metenier had run the theater for 4 seasons, but he really felt like it was impossible to keep the shocking stories going long term, so he sold the whole business to Maury.
Well, that change in leadership was a significant change in the tone of the offerings on stage. Maury had a lot of theater experience, but was not one of Paris's highbrow artistes. He wasn't especially concerned with continuing the style of naturalism for artistic integrity. He wanted to make the theater profitable, because it's a business.
Yeah.
Under his guidance, Grand Guignol gained a reputation for bloody, terrifying offerings.
And Maury catered to a sort of voyeuristic bloodlust in the audience. His lineups, filled with unsettling visuals that struck fear in viewers and made them question exactly where the line between theater and reality sat, came to be called Slice of Death as a counter to Metenier's Slice of Life dramas.
Maury was a masterful marketer of the Grand Guignol during this time. He hired a doctor to attend all the shows in case anybody needed to be treated for fainting, and he reveled in the publicity that that move brought. He measured the success of any given show by how many people fainted during it.
Yeah, they really were doing some very, very graphic, you know, beheadings, dismemberments, disembowelings, lots of stabbings and eye gougings. They were really, like, doing some pretty impressive onstage effects. And as a director, Max Mari was exacting. He may not have been driven by, you know, this intense artistic vision, but he was adamant that the plays had to be paced perfectly to maximize the effect of the comedy or horror that was being delivered to the audience. And he pushed the acting troupe, which is normally a group of about 14 actors, to extremes with endless rehearsals and some pretty cutting criticism that he could dole out. The actors were basically always on edge, arguments were frequent, so the behind-the-scenes drama was apparently just as heightened as that on the stage, although it was absent of the blood and dismemberment portions.
One of Mari's discoveries during this time was André Delorde, a novelist and playwright who collaborated with Dr. Alfred Binet, an experimental psychologist, to create stage scripts that explored insanity in depth. Delorde was a physician's son and had grown obsessed with death as a child. Binet, who was Delorde's doctor as well, found the patient frustratingly unwilling to do real self-examination. And he probably cut sessions short because he had ideas for plays while the two of them were talking.
Delorde had worked in other theater at the time, so when that was my note that he was sort of a discovery of Mari's, but discovery might be a weird word to use there and not entirely accurate. But he really, once he hooked up with the Grand Guignol, his career really blossomed, and it was because he was always consulting doctors and experts so that he could really get all of the gory stuff as accurate as possible. And it seems odd to me that your psychologist would also be your creative collaborator, but it seemed to work for them.
Well, and maybe, not even maybe, definitely also medically not ethical.
Right? You wouldn't be able to pull that off today, I don't think. But at the time, despite Binet's apparent willingness to talk about how Delorde wasn't doing his work on self openly, which, again, would not be ethical, they seemed to do really well in terms of putting plays together. And Delorde would eventually earn the nickname the Prince of Terror for his dozens and dozens of plays that combined this fascination with psychology and death with stories that had been sort of gleaned from newspapers and police reports. And that combination really examined the depths of humankind's savagery. Delorde favored insane asylums and surgeries for settings of his dramas, and his goal was to write a play that was so filled with terror that it would clear the entire audience within minutes of beginning. It's a weird goal.
When I was about 24 years old, I dated somebody whose goal was to write a book so scary nobody could get to the end of it. Anyway... All of this ultimately led to incredible success, so much that it is often Max Mari and not Oscar Metinier who's credited with starting the Grand Guignol. There was an average of 2 faintings per night, which just seemed to entice new audience members to come in. And those 2 people, by the way, were normally men. The Grand Guignol became celebrated as part of Parisian culture.
Yeah, the explanation that's often given as to why it was always men that fainted was because the ladies would cover their eyes when the scarier parts happened, whereas the men would not. But that, I think that matter could potentially be up to debate. The Grand Guignol's next director took the gory realism portrayed on stage to all new levels. But before we get into that, we're going to take a little break and have a word from one of our sponsors.
So whether you're in a suit or sweats, which, to be candid, I'm in sweats right now. I'm having a cozy day of podcast recording. You probably spend a lot of time in your underwear. I mean, if you don't, we're not going to judge you. But, I mean, probably you do. But instead of being something that makes a statement, a lot of people's underwear is really boring. But MeUndies is here to change that. Every pair of MeUndies is made from sustainably sourced modal, which is a fabric that is twice as soft as cotton. I am not kidding you. It is amazingly, seriously soft. Nothing can describe the fit and feel of MeUndies, but once you try them on, you will understand why they are called the world's most comfortable underwear. And if you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they are free, no questions asked. They have dozens of styles and limited edition prints to help you make a statement with your underwear, whether anyone can see them or not. Shipping is free in the United States and Canada, and you can save up to $8 a pair with the MeUndies subscription plan. Get the subscription or a single pair and get 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/history. That's MeUndies.com/history for 20% off your first order. One last time, that is MeUndies.com/history.
In 1915, the theater's directorship passed to Camille Choisy when Max Mari retired. Charles Zabel was also a financial partner, but it was Camille Choisy who was running things. And Choisy took the stagings of the theater to all new heights by way of special effects. So in addition to makeup and physical effects, which were already being done at the Grand Guignol, and which he elevated, he also used lighting and sound to carry the audience members along with the actors on stage into a world of insanity and gore and terror.
As the First World War played out, there was some concern that audiences would become so jaded by the events that were unfolding in Europe and abroad that the French theater of blood would stop being appealing. But Choisy opted to use the public's new knowledge to innovate in these plays. In addition to the knives and pistols, he started incorporating stories with grenades and poisonous gas, so themes obviously taken from the war.
And he was ever looking for ways to push the boundaries of realism to keep potentially bored audiences on the edge of their seats. So Choisy even purchased a full surgical setup for use as a set. Plays were also staged on sets that looked like the interiors of dirigibles and railroad cars and mines and factories. So the types of things that were on people's minds at this time. This is where I want to pause and remind you that that stage was only 20 by 20. So building out these sets had to have been an incredible work of like engineering and creativity.
It was also Choisy who hired actress Paula Maxa, who would become the celebrated star of the Grand Guignol. Compared to the famous Sarah Bernhardt as her horror equivalent, Maxa gained her fame through play after play in which her character was tortured or mauled, and in one play she even decomposed on stage over the course of several minutes. Over the course of her time at the Grand Guignol, she yelled help on stage more than 900 times, but that didn't really help her out because she was murdered in the theater more than 10,000 times.
Yeah, she, you know, when you're doing 4 to 7 plays a night, you can get killed over and over in the course of one evening as an actor. And by this time, with the range of special effects in each show continuing to grow, these actors became masters not only of portraying human emotion at the extremes of experience, but they also had to become incredibly skilled at simultaneously deploying the tricks of their trade that went far beyond, like, using blood packs and, like, having to explode one of those. Actors would have to trigger effects that made their faces appear to melt or their skin burst into flame or any number of other horrors while they were still doing the job of trying to act realistically.
As the spectacle grew, the Grand Guignol drew a wide-ranging audience. People who lived nearby would attend to enjoy some local theater, and the highbrow art set bought tickets to indulge in the darker themes on the stage there. Audiences would show up to openings in formal attire with BYOB champagne. Allegedly, the boxes in the back of the theater, which were quite private, were often the sites of romantic trysts.
And it was during Choisy's time at the helm that records were set at the Grand Guignol for faintings, as well as an increase in the number of audience members who would run out into the alley over the course of the evening to be sick. The effects had become so sophisticated that during one play when an actress had her eye gouged out on stage and then revealed the gaping hole in her skull, 6 members of the audience lost consciousness. On another evening, what looked for all the world like a real blood transfusion taking place on stage resulted in the record of 15 fainting attendees.
Choisy ran the theater for more than a decade before Jacques Jouvin became the director in 1926. Jouvin, who bought out Charles Zabel, really seemed to want to depart from what had gone on before, and in fact had made the Grand Guignol famous. Choisy stayed on for a while as a collaborator, but he left after 3 years to start a competing theater.
And Jouvin also fired crowd favorite Paula Maxa, who also left and started her own theater. Unfortunately, neither Maxa's venture nor Choisy's took flight, however.
The new director began to stage shows that were less creative and exploratory and set up one gag after another. He set slates that were thematic for a whole evening, sometimes all penned by the same writer. Sometimes there were multiple writers listed on the playbill, but they were all just his pseudonyms.
Yeah, he usually is characterized as kind of not understanding what the true magic of the Grand Guignol was. And without the artistry of storytelling that had teased out the tension and fear of a story, the audience lost interest. And additionally, the theater productions started to have to compete with the early Universal horror films. Dracula, starring Bela Lugosi, debuted in 1931. James Whale's Frankenstein also came out that same year. And while their roots were in many ways in the horror and the identity of horror and storytelling that had started at the Grand Guignol, they were now a very real threat to that theater, and attendance dwindled rapidly.
In 1937, a British actress named Eva Berkson took over this limping theater from Jouvin. For a while, it seemed like there was some hope for a return to the golden days of the Grand Guignol. Berkson relaunched the theater with a mix of old audience favorites and new plays, and she hired back Paula Maxa. But due to years of screaming, the former queen of the Theater of Blood had damaged her vocal instrument, and she could no longer scream like she once did.
Yeah, she really wasn't able to project, according to most accounts, or even speak much over like your standard speaking voice. Berkson was able, however, to bring audiences back. And for several years, the small former chapel once again was home to devoted crowds and spurting blood. But the German occupation of Paris in 1940 brought Berkson's involvement to a screeching halt. She fled. As a British national, it would have been incredibly dangerous for her to try to stay, although the theater did continue to mount productions in her absence.
Occupation slates were by and large repeats of the ones that had played under Choisy's leadership. The old director had returned in Berkson's absence to try to keep things going, and some of the occupying troops did attend, although the theater was deemed degenerate art, even though Hermann Göring quite liked it.
Yeah, there were apparently plans when Germany was finally victorious to basically like destroy the Grand Guignol and pretend it had never existed, just wipe it from the history books. But, as we know, that's not how the war played out. And Berkson once again resumed her leadership role at the Grand Guignol in 1944. And this time, when she returned from England, she had a husband who was Alexander Dundas. And World War II really dealt a severe blow to the theater. For one, there was some ill will in Paris that the Grand Guignol had stayed open to entertain the enemy troops. Berkson's return seemed to help smooth that over a little bit, and a visit from General Patton to the theater actually caused an uptick in ticket sales temporarily.
But the global conflict also gave audiences far too much real horror for a theater that was built around gore to hold any sort of appeal. To be truly shocked in the Guignol tradition would have required something far more sensational than the little stage could manage. In a 1947 interview with Time magazine, Eva Berkson said, "Really, I've almost come to the conclusion that the only way to frighten a French audience since the war is to cut up a woman on stage, a live woman, of course, and throw them to pieces."
During the 1947 season, in an effort to elicit some sort of excitement or thrill response from audiences, the Grand Guignol mounted productions that included La Laboratoire des Hallucinations, which featured a surgeon operating on the brain of his wife's lover on stage, and Un Crime dans une Maison de Fou, which was Crime in a Crazy House, where a pair of elderly inmates, all women, tortured a young, beautiful patient by driving a pair of scissors into her eye.
Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was the tradition of this theater.
I mean, I've had that response at several moments in this episode, but that one in particular. Even after testing out a variety of different formats and styles of theater, Berkson could just not regain a foothold in entertainment. In 1951, she retired from the Grand Guignol.
And next up, we're going to talk about the final years of the Théâtre du Grand Guignol. But before we do, we're going to pause one more time for another sponsor break. Trips to the post office are probably something that is second nature. We've always used the post office to send things. It seems easy because that's what you're used to. But think about all of that hassle. If you really break it down and do the math on your man hours that you're spending, you might realize that it's not the most efficient use of your time. So, thankfully, there is a much better way, and that is Stamps.com. Stamps.com is the easy and convenient way to get postage right from your desk. You can buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer. With Stamps.com, there is no guesswork. They make it easy to get the exact postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail, right at the instant that you need it. There's no expensive postage meter to worry about, you don't have to lease anything, and you don't have to make trips to the post office. So give it a try. Right now, you can sign up for Stamps.com and use our promo code, which is STUFF, to get this special offer. That is a 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and that magical digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in STUFF. That's Stamps.com, and enter STUFF. The last decade of the Grand Guignol was marked by struggle, artistic uncertainty, and rapid turnover. When Bergson stepped away from the theater, Max Maury's sons bought it, and the company manager, Charles Nonon, became the interim director.
The plays that were staged from 1951 to 1954 in an effort to try new things, since the old horror just wasn't working, were so far outside of the identity of the Grand Guignol that they just couldn't draw audiences. No one associated the theater in Impasse Chaptal with the musical reviews or long-form satire that were being tried during this time.
In 1954, there was a ray of hope. It arrived in the form of journalist and feminist Raymonde Machard, when she restarted the theater in its old tradition. But she hired new young writers to craft the short tales of Farce and Shock, which seemed to give it like an injection of life for a bit.
While it seemed like a turnaround, this optimism was really short-lived. Productions were plagued by very real problems and dangerous situations, which are difficult to distinguish from the publicity stunts that Machard was trying to do to reignite interest.
Yeah, there were a lot of stories coming out at this time, and people were not always sure what was real and what was just part of a stunt. So there was a kidnapping of one of the lead actresses, which was definitely fake. And even some of the more upsetting stories really remain a little bit murky. So apparently a leather harness is said to have nearly claimed the life of an actress when she tried to get into it backstage and she nearly hung herself. Another actress had a nervous breakdown on stage, and yet another was burned by a flame effect. There were a lot of problems.
So while Machard had managed to elicit a swell in ticket sales, the tone of things was a lot less realistic and a lot more campy, and the theater became more of a tourist attraction than a cultural icon.
Yeah, I think we've all seen this happen to places in various cities. Like the sort of cool underground thing that develops and becomes iconic pretty soon becomes more like an amusement park and less like itself. From 1959 to 1961, a man named Fred Pascal ran the theater. And some of the plays at this point veered back towards more realistic horror, but it was really too late to regain the glory days of Maury's and Choisy's times.
Charles Nonon once again became the director of the Grand Guignol in 1961, and he would be its last director. In an interview with Time magazine, he said, "Before the war, everyone felt what was happening on stage was impossible. Now we know these things and worse are possible in reality."
So after 65 years of frights and chills, the Grand Guignol closed its doors for good in November of 1962. The chapel-turned-theater reopened briefly as a new theatrical enterprise, not as the Grand Guignol, but that also quickly failed. And in March 1963, the entrance and portico of the space were demolished.
There were two spin-off theater companies launched in London that carried the name Grand Guignol, one in the 1920s and one in the 1940s, but neither of them ran for very long. The theater has been referenced in numerous films throughout the years, both documentary and fictional, including the first season of Penny Dreadful.
Yeah, if you watch a show, and I do because it's fantastic, there's a whole whole episode that is titled Grand Guignol. And there is also a similar theater in the book and subsequent film Interview with a Vampire called Théâtre des Vampires. But apparently author Anne Rice has said that she did not know about the Grand Guignol when she wrote of the theater, which if you missed either the book or that film, audiences believed they were watching fiction but were in fact observing real deaths at the hands of vampires. So it was sort of like the snuff film equivalent of a theater.
Today, theater companies around the world still stage modern productions of some of the surviving plays for the Grand Guignol.
Yeah, there are actually textbooks on how to stage Grand Guignol plays, and there are, because, you know, for a modern audience, if you stage them as written, they would probably seem very hokey in some cases, although they were doing some pretty amazing stuff with effects at the time. And in fact, the word Grand Guignol has kind of come to be associated with shocking, sort of extreme horror. So it's taken on a life of its own. Like I said, it shows up sort of everywhere. You'll be, now that you have heard of it, if you hadn't before, you will start to see it everywhere. And now you know what it's referencing. So that is the Grand Guignol. That's one of those things that if, I could time travel, I would probably pick as a place to visit.
Not me.
I think it would be kind of spectacular.
You do that.
Not you.
I'm not into it.
I will report back if I remain conscious after both my time travel and seeing a terrifying play. Or a terrifying play and a comedy and a terrifying play and a comedy and one more terrifying play. Yeah, I think it would be spectacular, which is why I thought it would be perfect Halloween fare for the podcast. But now I have not scary at all listener mail.
Okay.
This comes from our listener, Jenna, and she sent it with a postcard, but it was a parcel. And she says, hello, Holly and Tracy. Obviously, I'm not sending this from Stockholm, which is what the postcard depicts, but I was recently there and I picked this up with a mind to send it to you. I work on a cruise ship as a production manager of entertainment and travel all around the world, and I am currently home awaiting a visa to my next job in Dubai. I love listening to the podcast and hearing about places I've been just so I can say, hey, I've been there. And now that I'm home for a little while, I've caught up with my backlog of episodes. Cruise ship Wi-Fi, she says, not so good, while I spend my time sewing. You guys are great to listen to while I work, and I get to learn while sewing, two things I love. So in this package, I've included some of the things I make for you to use. I hope you like them and find some use out of them. I've got several I made for myself that I use while traveling for work. Thank you so much for the podcast. Jenna, thank you so much. She made us these two beautiful little cosmetic bags, which... mine is going to become pretty standard in my travels going forward because I love it so much.
Yep. You sent me a picture. I'm very excited to pick mine up from you the next time we're in the same place.
We are actually traveling right after we record this. So Tracy will get hers very soon because I will bring it to where we are going. And yeah, it was just so sweet and they're beautifully made. So thank you, Jenna. We just love them and they're delightful. If you would like to write to us, you can do so at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. You can also connect with us across all of social media just by looking for Missed in History, which is our name on virtually everything. We're on Twitter at Missed in History, at facebook.com/MissedInHistory, at missedinhistory.tumblr.com. We're on Pinterest as Missed in History and on Instagram as Missed in History. So we hope to see you at all of those. If you would like to do a little bit of research, you can go to our parent site, How Stuff Works. You can type in the words horror or Halloween, and you're going to get all kinds of results to explore and keep you busy. You can also visit us at missedinhistory.com for a backlog of every episode we have ever had of the podcast before Tracy and I, all the way to present day, as well as show notes on any of the episodes that Tracy and I have worked on together. So we encourage you, come and visit us at howstuffworks.com and missedinhistory.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances. Whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death, we all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
You don't put those inside of you, do you?
This is a show about women.
I mean, you do?
Yes.
Finally, a show about women that isn't just a thinly veiled aspirational nightmare. It's not hosted, not narrated. We're just dropping into a woman's world.
I found out when my dad was gay when I was 10. We were in a convertible on the 405 freeway, listening to the B-52s. And looking back, I should have said, this is gay. This is already all gay.
Listen to Finally a Show on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.